Voices that inspire the extended interview.
My name is Mimi Graham, and I'm director of the FSU Center for Prevention and Early Intervention Policy.
So what does that mean?
Our mission revolves around the first 1,000 days of life from conception to age 3. We have amazing science now that shows that that's such a pivotal time for not only the brain development, but for really a foundation of your social, emotional well-being and health. And so everything that we do is to nurture and improve that early time, particularly for vulnerable children. We work with teen parents and their children, Early Head Start, which are disadvantaged families, and then we work with Baby Courts, which is one of my favorite programs, and we're bringing a therapeutic approach to these families that have had a lot of trauma.
So you actually then go in and help train the court people, the judges, the staff, about why it's so critical that they be thinking of the child's best welfare in these early days and in the types of sentencing or how parents are treated. How do you do that? How do you work that?
So as a university, training and education is something that we do, and we like to translate the knowledge for folks that really don't understand it. So for example, we know that stranger anxiety is about 9 months of age when the brain matures enough that they know you are not my mom. And so that's like the worst time to make transitions for young children. And babies around their first birthday are the highest group coming into child welfare, because of some kind of substance abuse or issues. So we help educate all those, you know, from the judges to the caseworkers about how important those developmental times are and to help inform their decisions so they don't make decisions that are re-traumatizing. So I was a guardian ad litem for a case where a baby had been for 15 months with our friend Talithia Edwards and her family, and the dad comes out of nowhere, and they take this baby that had been, you know, the only family he'd ever known for 15 months, and moved him abruptly to the father because he was the bio dad. It was tragic for everybody involved. So we changed the law. It is Senate Bill 80, and now that it must be considered the family that a child is with, and if they've had a nurturing relationship, that that's considered equal to any kind of blood relative that happens to show up.
Well, congratulations. That's huge.
It is huge. So a lot of times we have good interest. We have good intentions about what we do with young children, but the fact is separating kids from their attachments is stressful and can cause lifelong damage. So helping folks to understand, we've done a lot of education on trauma-informed child care and created a training for DCF on that. We're creating now a trauma-informed training for judges that's online so they can understand that almost everybody that comes into the court has trauma, and then coming to court in itself can be traumatic. And so how can it be more therapeutic? So with Baby Court, one of the things we do is we bring the therapy to the courts. So we train licensed mental health folks in something we call child-parent psychotherapy. So you're dealing with the parent and the child simultaneously, because many of the parents grew up in the system. They don't know how to be parents. So one of my favorite stories...
Share.
Yeah, one of the original families. So a mom had lost 7 kids to the system because of her substance use problem. She came into our early childhood court. She got the therapy. It turns out she was raped when she was 7 years old. She never got any kind of therapy. So she'd been doing drugs to self-medicate all these years. So when she got the trauma treatment, you know, she got clean, she got sober, she got the seventh baby back. So what if she'd had that therapy when she was seven, or when she'd had the first baby or the second baby? And so it really, you know, spurred all of us, you know, with those kinds of outcomes to say, okay, this is really important. We've been looking at just the substance use rather than the underlying root cause of it, which is often trauma. So we are now in our 10th year of baby court across the state, and it's really changing the trajectory for these parents and stopping that multi-generational cycle, because when you heal the underlying trauma, you can stop the cycle of maltreatment and substance use. So I'm passionate about it, and as more people find out about it, it's like, wow, you know, we can really change our systems so we're not re-traumatizing folks. We're really solving it at the root problem.
Mimi, how did you get into this? How did you find this path, this passion for this work? Where did that come from?
Well, I had a great childhood, and I found out in high school that some people had never had a birthday cake and party. So I think I made 100 cakes my senior year in high school. And it's like, you know, how can we help every kid have a happy childhood? And then when I found out, I mean, and I majored in child development and did that, but when I found out about the adverse childhood experiences, it just like made it all made sense that, you know, it what happens in those early years really is the foundation of who you become. And how can we help those kids who have had, you know, adversity in early childhood? How can we build up their resilience? And what we know is that all it takes is one nurturing relationship that can really buffer the stress and change the trajectory for kids. But some kids don't even have that one person, you know. So we work now with teenagers that are involved in the criminal justice system who then are parents. And so I was talking to the nurse this morning. You know, we have an 18-year-old dad. He's in the detention center, and he's expecting his baby in September. And it's like one of the judges recently let one of our teen dads go to the birth of his baby and said, you know, this could be the most important day of your life. Of what kind of father do you want to be? And probably you didn't have the kind of dad that you needed, but you can change that trajectory, and you can be that kind of dad. You know, so how do we do that? You know, a lot of times it's just being there for kids, whether they're 3 or whether they're 18, you know, to help them, you know, change the trajectory and help them believe in themselves. So building resilience is something we're really not just talking about trauma, but how do we change the trajectory and build up the resilience?
So we were talking before we start recording that you're part of a center that really came out of a vision that our former governor, Lawton Childs, had. So talk about how that came to be, how he got involved in caring about the importance of those early days of a child's life.
Yes, we are so indebted to Lawton Childs. So he was on the National Infant Mortality Commission when he was a senator in Washington and looked at the data about Florida. And it's like our infant mortality rates, particularly for brown and black families, is double what it is for white families. And he had his own low birth weight grandson and went to the NICU and was like, we've got to do something differently. So he came back to Florida and started the FSU Center for Prevention. It was at the law school, and this was in 1989. And then his friends convinced him to run for governor and were successful. And he brought that passion, and he started Florida's Healthy Start. And we were with him every step of the way of really seeing his vision for, you know, really leaving no child behind. starting, you know, prenatally. So I've been there now since 1990, and we've strived all these years. And for some things, like low birth weight, we still haven't moved the dime on, you know, the low birth weight and infant mortality. Some things we've made huge strides, and the explosion of the brain research really helped gather support, like from the Chamber of Commerce and from others that before had thought it was kind of a touchy-feely kind of thing to be involved in early childhood. But now we really have robust science about how the brain develops. It's one of the only organs that's not fully formed at birth. So we have this great opportunity in those first years, but there's still such misunderstanding, like we're putting money into third grade reading instead of three-year-old language development. And 80% of the brain is formed by age 3 and 90% by age 5. The full brain development is not totally developed till age 25, but those first years are when you have the greatest impact to, you know, really wire, hardwire the brain for healthy development.
Which is such important information. So thinking about if by 5, the majority of the brain is already formed, we need to make sure that what's being fed into that brain for that baby is important you know, love, language, attachment, all the things that then help that child have a successful, healthy life.
Absolutely. And yet our policies are, you know, we're focused on kindergarten readiness and 3 and 4 year olds. And, you know, it's really late by then. There was a study of that kids from low-income families may have heard as less as 30 million fewer words by the time that they're 4 years old than children of working parents who are talking to their kids. And part of it is that, you know, poor kids, their moms are working 2 or 3 jobs, or, you know, they're sitting in their car seat or whatever. But there's so many things that we could do that really don't cost any money, you know, just encouraging talking and singing and laughing and spending time with your baby.
Right. And there's language all around us. You know, you go to the supermarket, there's words everywhere. There's signs. There's so many games you can play with your child as you're in your busy day.
Yes, just the peekaboo. I mean, we can change the world with peekaboo. You know, it is the serve and return. It really doesn't matter whether the dad's reading the Wall Street Journal to the baby or reading the sports page or, you know, just that interaction. But so many adults are on their phones or their devices or they're working, and, you know, we still have a long way to go to help parents understand how important those early years are. But most parents are exhausted. They're sleep deprived, and it's like, and you want me to play with the baby? You know, so I think we need to do a much better job in supporting families in those early years and making it easier for them.
Which is why it's so good that you're seeing that business community through Chamber, the, you know, Florida Chamber has really gotten behind telling that story of why these years are so critical for the health of our future workforce, for all the things that are connected to it. So having that messaging finally being told in those business rooms and having them realize that they have a role to play. Like, how can we have more work-friendly policies, family-friendly policies in our workplaces so that families aren't just so exhausted that they can afford quality childcare, all these things that are really important.
And we know during the COVID that families got support, and we really reduced the poverty. We helped give families what they needed to actually spend time with their kids. So family leave is something that's really important. And we're really blessed to have our Children's Services Council in Leon that we hope will also be really investing wisely in kindergarten readiness, which means starting, you know, in the first 1,000 days of life, of really supporting families so that the children can thrive.
So, Mimi, the series, of course, is called Voices That Inspire. What keeps you, this is hard work, what keeps you inspired in the work you're doing?
many things inspire me. The children inspire me. One of my first jobs was as principal of the Melman Center for Child Development, and we had kids with disabilities. And there was a little girl that the doctor said would be a vegetable. She would never talk or walk. And we had physical therapy and all the different therapies, and we worked with this little girl. And at age three, she's talking and walking. And, I mean, little Bernice, she is inspiring to me that we can change the trajectory for these kids. And then when we work with families, you know, and we see them when we address their trauma, that they can get clean and sober and be good parents. Everybody wants to be a good parent, you know, and so how do we give them the tools to overcome whatever adversity there is? So, you know, and I think our policies are not yet where we want them to be. And so I feel like we got to keep going. So our baby courts are great, but we're only serving 7% of the eligible kids. Why aren't we serving all of them? Our developmental screening rates, we're only screening 25% of our kids 0 to 3. Well, you know, it's not rocket science. Why can't we get them all screened? So to me, there's so many policies that, you know, would be easy to implement and that we still, in our community, in our state, and in our world, we look at the world for babies and the trauma of bombing the maternity hospital and the things that the violence that these young children are enduring. And it's across the world. It's also, you know, across the street in our community. And so what we know is that adversity can have lifelong consequences. So how do we help heal the world? How do we help bring kindness and nurturing and the good things that we know enrich our lives and overcome the adversity? So,
yeah, just as I was driving today, just a powerful story on NPR about a mother in Gaza who has a 5-month-old baby with not enough milk and resources and food, and just the trauma that she felt, that, you know, the baby felt, it's overwhelming at times. So what would you want someone who hears this, what do you want them to take away? What's one thing you want someone listening to know that they can do to be supportive of children?
That we all have a role to play in nurturing children, whether we're at the grocery store or whether they're our kids or grandkids, you know, spending the time with young children and know that it's not just wasting time and not babysitting, but realizing that, you know, every interaction that we have with young children either makes things better or it makes things worse. And we all can be that person that smiles at the baby, you know, in the grocery store, or the baby that's crying at Walmart at 10 o'clock at night, and speak for the baby. Boy, it's really late, past my bedtime, you know, and to be sympathetic with parents and figure out how we can be supportive, and to know that these incredible first years are so pivotal to your whole development, and we don't get them back, you know. So take the time now to play with the baby and take them to the park, and, you know, and it's not things that cost things. It's spending the time. It's the bird watching, or, you know, just reading the book in your lap, or those kinds of things. I love, like, the Reach Out and Read program where our pediatricians are giving out books. It's not just about the literacy. You got to hold the child to read them the book. So it's the nurturing and the attachment that you're supporting, as well as the love of books and literacy.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add to this conversation? I mean, you've said some great things.
Yes. So one of the most important things I've learned is that it's all about relationships. And so we've done a lot of work in infant mental health, which people still don't understand either. They think of a baby on a psychiatrist's bed. But it's really about relationships from birth to old age. Our lives are most enriched by relationships. In fact, Harvard has this study that looked at longevity, and they asked people, you know, what was the most important thing of their life, their income, their job, or their relationships. And consistently, the relationships are what enrich people's lives. That's how we get policy done. That's what, you know, when we get old, it's not, well, I wish I'd worked more. It's like, how much time did we spend? And our colleagues are so important, and our, you know, our community. And so enriching relationships enriches our lives, and it enriches the people we have relationships with. So early and long relationships are very important.
All right.
I could say one more thing. So one of the things we, when Governor Childs was here and we started Healthy Start, we were doing home visits, and I went on a home visit and they talked about the weather. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is a missed opportunity. So there really wasn't a curriculum for prenatal home visiting. So we started looking at the research and compiling it. And then our friends wanted it. We made these books. And we've now sold $25 million of home visiting curricula through FSU. We think we've impacted probably a million families, thousands of home visitors, nurses, social workers, paraprofessionals that work with pregnant and parenting families to help them to have a healthier baby and a happier baby. And so we are so proud of the work that we've done at FSU to really translate the research into practical applications of what you do with your baby. And then we were able to make it digital during the COVID so that the home visitors could text these handouts to the families about how to take your baby's temperature, you know, how to read to your baby, all those kinds of things. So I'm so proud of the work that we've done. Our books are, and now they're digital, it's used all over the world. The military uses it in their new family support program. So so FSU is doing so many wonderful things, and we're so happy to really be a part of FSU and to translate research into practical application families can use.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mimi, for all that you're doing, that your center is doing, your leadership on this issue, and preaching it from the mountaintops or our highest sandhills, whatever it is.
Mimi Graham, Director, FSU Center for Prevention and Early Intervention Policy.